So on this 8th day of February 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are reading from Chapter 18, The Perfection of Renunciation, text number 50. Now I think we have such a large number that everyone can have cannot have a book. Can you sit with him so he can also see?
I have my iPod.
He has his own iPod, he can see. Okay. Ready? Siddhim prapto yata brahma.
Siddhim prapto yata brahma.
Tatapnoti nibodhame. Samase naiva kaunteya.
Samase naiva kaunteya.
Nishta jnanasya yapara. I'm going to read the translation again. O son of Kunti, learn from me how one who has achieved this perfection can attain to the supreme perfectional stage, Brahman, the stage of highest knowledge, by acting in the way I shall now summarize. Om jnanat marandasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshu unmiditam mena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So this is the final summary section of the Bhagavad Gita, as it is. The Bhagavad Gita has 18 chapters in a larger work known as the Mahabharata, which is a great epic history of India, one of the two best known, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. And within this Mahabharata, which more or less tells the story of the five Pandava brothers led by Arjuna, who were cheated out of the kingdom by their cousins, Duryodhana and his brothers, and their father. And Krishna, who is the friend of the Pandavas, this is the side of Dharma or good, they're trying to recapture the kingdom for the benefit of the people in general, so that there'll be a religious king, religious leadership. So within that larger epic are these 18 chapters of Bhagavad Gita. And the scene is that Arjuna suddenly has cold feet, so to speak. He's this great fighter. He's very skilled in fighting, known to conquer enemies everywhere. And yet when he sees who's on the other side of the battle, he hesitates to fight because they're his friends, they're his cousins, there's a teacher is there, the grandfather who's the grandsire of the whole dynasty. So it's not that he's afraid to fight, but that he doesn't want to kill his relatives and those who are intimate to him. And so the whole Bhagavad Gita is spoken in order to convince Arjuna that the higher duty he has is to overcome these bodily feelings that he has, these relationships, and to work for the higher good of Dharma, and basically as a servant of what Krishna wants, when Krishna is in the role of the Supreme Person or God. And in the course of this conversation, Krishna summarizes all the teachings of the Upanishads. The Upanishadic teaching. So this Gita is sometimes known as the Gita Upanishad. If you look at the title page, you see that. So this last chapter is known as the Perfection of Renunciation. And the beginning of the verse we just read says Siddhim Prapto means attaining this perfection. And that's coming from the previous verse, which is the perfection of renunciation and freedom from reaction. The basic understanding that Krishna gives at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita is that all of us are eternal. We're not these bodies. These bodies are just temporary vehicles that we inhabit for a short period of time. And we've been through many, many bodies. The human body is very rare, but it's just intrinsically not different from any of the other bodies we see. The dogs and the cats and the birds. They're all vehicles for the conscious being, the soul or the atma. And that soul or atma, when in the contact with matter, which is alien, ultimately alien to the soul, which is pure spirit, we acquire what we call conditioning in contact with the modes of nature. Now, the modes of nature are important to understand. It's not something that directly relates to, like something we can get from Western philosophy or science. But it's something that we can easily understand if we see the effects of the modes. A mode of nature is a something that is really within our mind, and that we act and we in a certain way if we're in a certain mode, and that's explained in chapter 14. For instance, someone in the mode of passion, we've all experienced it. Someone in the mode of passion or rajas, is always very eager to enjoy, very eager to make money, work very hard for that. Maybe easily becomes angry when he's frustrated, he or she is frustrated in their desires, and is characterized by this, someone purely in the mode of, these modes don't appear purely, but purely in the mode of passion, predominantly the mode of passion, say, will be like a type A personality. You know, work 18-hour days to get ahead in the business, you know, make it, and prestige and all of these different things are very important to that such a person. Someone in the mode of goodness may be more thoughtful, peaceful. They're more contemplative. They may think about philosophical things like this. Someone in the mode of ignorance, a lazy, likes to, you know, take maybe get drunk and just live for the moment, has a tendency toward, you know, foolishness or madness. These are people who, you know, we meet unfortunate people like that who may be under the influence of drugs. This is another way of gauging of someone in the mode of ignorance. Dirty, you know, this don't clean. That's the mode of ignorance. So In the contact with these different modes, we take a certain combination of them. None of us are purely in each one. We have a certain predominant mode. And we'll act. And when we're acting what we call fruitively, which is for our own ego, then we incur what is called karma. And those are reactions. Now, karma is a very subtle law. We kind of intuit it. You know, this whole phrase, what goes around comes around, is very common. You have a sense that, oh, yeah, you know, something bad happened to that person? Right. Because like sometime in the past, maybe in this life or previous, they did something. Right? Or if, you know, that incurs that reaction. And also, if you do good things, you know, if you're very kind, you're very generous, you're charitable, you go the extra mile to help a friend or in general people, then you know that that's going to help you. You know, that it's auspicious for you. And indeed, Krishna describes it. The beginning is, we're not these bodies. We're eternal. That means we go body after body after body. This is our destiny. Now, we can't see it. We can't remember, you know, previous lives. But we can see that even in this life, we can't remember. I can't remember. Can anyone here remember when they were 1 year old? I don't think so. Certainly don't remember details. But you know that we were 1 year old. Your mother will tell you, yes, you did this, you walked like this, you did like that. You certainly were there. But the memory isn't there. So, because the trauma of death and rebirth erases your memory. Or let's say it buries it very deeply. But the traces of what you did, what you desired, your good and bad karma, stays with you. In the subtle realm of what we call the subtle body. The mind, the intelligence, and the ego. That doesn't die. When this body dies, that stays intact and carries you forth to the next body. This is explained in the 15th chapter very nicely. So here in the previous verse, in text 49, he says, the one who is self-controlled and unattached, who disregards all material enjoyments, in other words, is not working egotistically, by practice of renunciation, the title of the chapter, the highest perfect stage of freedom from reaction is there. This is called Naishkarmya. The basic principle of Vedic knowledge, whether it's bhakti yoga or some other kind of yoga, is to try to work in such a way that you can move toward breaking your bonds in this round of samsara. This samsara is a concept that's there in Buddhism as well. It's that it's a circle, it's a cycle. Birth, you see, growth, sustenance, old age, disease, death. Birth, that, like that, around and around and around we go. And this is a cycle of suffering. We're not meant to do that because, remember, it was spirit, not matter. Matter, the physical body, is born. It grows. It gets old. It dies. But you as spirit don't. You don't get old. You don't die. But because, spirit is consciousness, because we're identifying ourselves as these bodies, we feel as if, yes, I'm getting old. Now I'm young. That's an old person. And the wonderful thing is, this is an illusory energy. This is an energy that covers our knowledge. So we think that we're constitutionally this way. And I remember a story I'll tell from when I lived in Miami. I was still in the movement where I was living right on the beach. We had a hotel there, as a temple. This was in the 80s. and Miami Beach. You know, you'd see people coming and going and on vacation. But there were also many old people who had retired there. They lived in the hotels and places like that. So they had just built a boardwalk at great expense, and people were walking up and down naturally in the boardwalk. What do they do? So there was a contingent who would come up from Brazil. You know, during their winter months, they would come up to Miami. And during the winter months in Canada, which is just the opposite, they would come down to Miami. So we always had tourists coming. So this was the summer or the spring or something. The Brazilians were there. And they were all, you know, kind of beautiful people. You know, they're obviously from wealthy families. They were in very good shape. They would play volleyball on the beach. You know, this is what you do. Volleyball, go in there and preen a little bit. So we would go out and chant Hare Krishna, you know, and we'd observe. You know, we go on the boardwalk. So you had all these retired people. Now they, you know, even you're down your Miami Beach, you're still feeling the burden of old age. And they would walk up and down if they could, you know, with their walkers or something on the boardwalk. Just 20, 30 feet from the young Brazilians playing their games, you know. So you could see that the Brazilians, they weren't looking at those old people and thinking, oh, that's going to be me sometime. You know, because I remember when I was, you know, 20, 21, you know, you think that there's these constitutionally old people and there's constitutionally young people, and I happen to be lucky to be one of the young people. That's how you act, even though, you know, obviously that's not true. You don't project and say, that's going to be me, isn't it? This is why, you know, they draft the young people in for the war, because you have this kind of sense of immunity, you know, because you're in your the height of your health. But the fact is that time takes its toll. And the young become old, and the old become dead, and the dead become alive again. The dead are not, you know, that's just an illusion. Nobody dies. Death is a total illusion. But if we identify under this illusion with this gross body, we'll feel as if we're getting old, as if we're dying. You know. Now I'll be honest with you. I've been in this movement for 38 years. I'm 63 now. My friend Bhakta Alec is only 19, is it? He's 19 years old. But you can ask him. I'm also dancing around, chanting, and doing the same thing. I honestly don't feel, oh, God, I'm 63, oh, woe is me. You know? Now, of course, I'm going to probably leave this body, hopefully, a lot sooner than he's going to leave that body. But that doesn't matter. The point is, this Krishna consciousness is on the spiritual platform. And even though the body doesn't cooperate as much, I can't do as much dancing and jumping as I used to, that's no big deal. The spirit is stays young. Because spirit doesn't age, doesn't get old. So, now, back to our verses here. So what Krishna is saying here is that when one, he's talking about actually working in the world in a way that doesn't entangle you. And that takes an art, it takes instruction from the Bhagavad Gita and from experienced souls. So he's saying, having attained that perfection of freedom from reaction, in other words, working spiritually in the mood of devotion, not selfishly, that's what he's talking about, then one can go further and come up to the platform of Brahman. This is mentioned here, the Brahman stage. Brahman stage is beyond these modes of nature. It's when one is we'll see the qualities in text 54 here. Very joyful. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma. Our natural state is to be full of joy. If you're not always full of happiness, it means that you're in an unnatural state. Okay, well, how can we get to that? I want to be full of joy. Not artificial, not something that's going to come and go, but something that's steady. This word nishta means steady. That's the nature of the soul. But when we forget the supreme source of all happiness and joy, you know, the supreme person, and we identify with this limited body, then our happiness is coming and going. Sukha, dukkha, the dualities. And it's very limited. So let's read now how we can come up to that state of Brahman. That's what he's talking about here. The highest perfectional state, simply by being engaged in his occupation, performing the duty for the sake of the Supreme Personality of God. Any discussions on these few points? Is this a class that's come? Yes. Anyway, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer either now or afterward. Okay, so let's go on. I'm just going to chant the Sanskrit, then I'll read the English without it. Buddhya vishuddhya yukto dhrityatmanam niyamya cha Shabdadin Vishayan Chakva Ragadvesham Yudasicha. Vivikta Sevi Lugvashi Yatavak Kayamanasaha. Dhyana Yoga Paro Nityam Vairagyam Samupashitaha. Ahankaram Balam Darpam Kamam Krodham Padigraham. Vimucha Nimamuk Shanto Brahma Bhuyaya Kalpate. Being purified by his intelligence and controlling the mind with determination, giving up the objects of sense gratification, being freed from attachment and hatred, one who lives in a secluded place, who eats little, who controls his body, mind, and power of speech, who is always in trance, and who is detached, free from false ego, false strength, and false pride, lust, anger, and acceptance of material things, free from false proprietorship, and peaceful, such a person is certainly elevated to the position of self-realization. That's quite a list. Purport. When one is purified by intelligence, he keeps himself in the mode of goodness. Thus one becomes the controller of the mind and is always in trance. He is not attached to the object of sense gratification, and he is free from attachment and hatred in his activities. Such a detached person naturally prefers to live in a secluded place. He does not eat more than what he requires, and he controls the activities of his body and mind. He has no false ego because he does not accept the body as himself. Nor has he a desire to make the body fat and strong by accepting so many material things. Because he has no bodily concept of life, he is not falsely proud. He is satisfied with everything that is offered to him by the grace of the Lord. And he is never angry in the absence of sense gratification. Nor does he endeavor to acquire sense objects. Thus, when he is completely free from false ego, he becomes not attached to all material things. And that is the stage of self-realization of Brahman. That stage is called the Brahma-Bhuta stage. When one is free from the material conception of life, he becomes peaceful and cannot be agitated. This is described in Bhagavad Gita 270. This is the beginning of the book, second chapter. Apuyamanam achala pratishtam samudramapa prabhashanti yadvat tadvat kama yang prabhashanti sarve sashantim apnoti nakama kami. A person who is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve peace, and not the man who strives to satisfy such desires. So this is a formula here. Now, of course, this Krishna is winding up, and a lot of these things were mentioned before in his description of yoga. The Bhagavad Gita describes like a yoga ladder. Sometimes you can consider it that way. There's four different kinds of yoga here. You've got karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, and bhakti yoga. Karma yoga is the yoga of action, which means that, which is described in this chapter also, that you work in your prescribed duty. Each of us has a certain psychophysical nature, things that we like to do. So if we work that way, but we don't covet the fruits. We live simply and minimally, and whatever extra we have, we give over for the process of sacrifice. Now, sacrifice means for the benefit of the Supreme. Here, for instance, everything that we do is dedicated for the glorification and service of Krishna, of God. And we get our joy and our happiness from that service. We're not getting anything material. Look at this wardrobe, you know. It takes. My friend is going to India, and he may spend $30 on a bunch of shirts, what we call kurtas, and sheet-like dhotis, and that's it for the year. You know, he'll have plenty, just $30. How can you live like that in America? $30 for maybe a shirt, right? Right?
David called it the Superman wardrobe. It's just the same color cloth.
Yeah. So, but the idea is that. That means that we're not so into the whole thing of, you know, decorating the body and making it very attractive. That's not what we're into. Well, then how do we get any happiness? You know, well, it's coming from the actual contact we get with the Supreme through the process of bhakti. This mantra you see here, this is known as the Maha Mantra. We'll maybe talk about this. This is our chief process of yoga, of chanting this mantra. If we were all sitting here at 5:15. To 7:15, 2 hours, you would see us chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. You can imagine I have a rosary. We have just like this rosary, but we have a long rosary, it's 108 beads, and we're chanting the Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And what are we doing? we're chanting this mantra. It has special potency. This is the way we meditate. And when you become practiced at it, and you really absorb the mind, there's a tremendous joy that comes just from the chanting. Just from the chanting. Because Krishna is, he's God. He's not just powerful, but he's all attractive. He's all attractive. Why, if God is infinitely powerful and can create universes, and he knows everything, he's in our hearts, so he's omniscient, he's omnipresent, why can't he be, as I said before, omnibeautiful? In other words, if he's infinite, he's also infinitely beautiful. He's the best jokester. He's the most skilled everything, right? Why just, some vague idea? This is the great glory of the Vedic culture. It gives the details about the absolute truth. Everything that's here must be there. If you take it in a philosophical way, that everything has a cause, and we are the effect of so many causes. Take this building, right? What caused it to come from nothing? Well, it didn't come from nothing. We know that a certain amount of cement, a certain amount of steel, a certain amount of other elements were brought together according to someone's idea, right? They made a blueprint. Someone had to pay for it. All of these things together form the different causes for this building, right? And always there was an intelligence behind it. There's always an intelligent person. So there can't be anything in this building that wasn't in all of these causes. Whether it's the cement, the idea, the blueprint, the desire, all of that together caused this building, right? So behind all of those things, there's a person. There's a person behind it. Similarly, we ourselves, right? We are also the causes of, are the effects of so many causes. Just like an education. Why do you get an education? Well, because you want to transform yourself by a certain amount of knowledge, so you'll have, you'll live in the world better. Maybe you get a better job, you'll be happier, right? Well, that means that there's persons. There's teachers, there's books who are written by persons, there's buildings that were put together by... Everywhere you look, there's personality. And therefore, there has to be a source of the personality, because everything has a cause and effect, cause and effect. Nothing can be an effect that doesn't have... There can't be more in the effect as in the cause. That's just like a physical, a principle of physics. Where a sum of these different causes makes the effects. So now let's think about personality. What does personality mean? Well, when you're talking about a person, the first thing you want to know, what's his name? Her name, isn't it? That's why if the police are looking and say, well, who is it? What's the name? And then they want a description, right? Well, are they tall? Are they short? Male, female, old, young, blonde, brunette, whatever. And the more they can get, then the more they'll define the person. But then they want to know, well, what are they like? What do they work at? What's their job? So there's certain qualities. So you have the name, you have the form, you have the qualities, and then you have the activities, right? Then when you have all those things, the more you have it, you understand what that person is, right? So there's much more to it. Of course, there's a conscious being there. It's very complex. But those are the ways that we can easily define a person in general. So the idea is that if we have love, we have hatred, we have form, certainly, we have likes and dislikes, then there must be that in the original person. There must be a source of that. There must be a source. And so when we, in the philosophical vein, there's something called the Vedanta Sutra. Sutras are little aphorisms, little bitty statements in Sanskrit that carry great meaning. So the Vedanta means the end of knowledge. Anta means end, Veda means knowledge. So the summary of all the Vedic knowledge, philosophical knowledge, is there in the Vedanta Sutra. So the Vedanta Sutra begins with this sutra or aphorism. It says, Atato Brahma Jigyasa, which means simply, now then, being a human being, intelligent and inquisitive into truth, you should search out Brahman. Now, if you recall that this, we're talking about the Brahma-Bhuta platform, so we're talking about the same thing here. So, what is that Brahman? Well, that's answered in the next sutra. Janma-dyasya yataha, which means that from which everything is emanated, you see? And that which maintains and ultimately destroys everything, that's Brahman. So just the part about creation. So the human life means to inquire and search for that source of everything. That's our that's our success. Otherwise, if we just remain attentive to the effects and the relativities, we won't progress in our mission, remember, to get out of this relative limited life of samsara and return to our spiritual platform called Brahma-Bhuta, where there's no death, no birth, no disease, and no old age. But there is personality. There is form. There is activities. That's, or there are, let's say. That's what is unknown generally in Western philosophy and Western religion. That there are all these things going on there. Everything we have here is simply a reflection of that. This is the reflection. That's the reality. This is a dream. That's the reality. We're dreaming that we're, you know, 20, 30, 40 years old. But it's temporary. Just like any dream. When it's happening, it's very real to you. But then when you wake up, you say, oh, that was just a dream. It's not substantial. The same thing is true of this life. It seems to be real, but it doesn't last. And as Krishna says at the beginning, anything that doesn't last, anything that's not eternal, is ultimately not real. So we have to search for that reality. Reality, the beautiful. The ultimate beauty is there in the spiritual world, in the reality of Krishna. So that's the Brahma-Bhuta platform. Now, to get to that point, we need to cultivate these qualities in this 51 to 53. And the fact is that the process of bhakti yoga, by engaging in it, you develop these qualities. If you just read them, you just says, well, that's impossible. You know, I mean, there's so many things here. Being free from false ego, from acceptance of material things. Well, I have so many material things. I need material things. Got to have a certain, you know, amount. But here he's talking about false proprietorship. The idea is that ultimately we don't own anything. You know, then you can't take it with you, right? So ultimately Krishna says, mrityu sarva harashtaham. As death, I take everything away. No one can deny it. You may be a multi-billionaire, you may be Bill Gates, or you may be some poor fellow on the street. But when you leave this body, you're equal. Bill Gates leaves it all here, and so does this fellow. He leaves his basket with it, he's pushing it. What's the difference? So that kind of accumulation, that kind of identification and proprietorship doesn't get us anywhere. It keeps us bound to this world. So here, we're going to read the next verse. This next verse is a very significant verse. And know that the process of devotional service, beginning with chanting the holy name, cultivates all these qualities that we just read in 51 to 53 and brings you to this Brahma-Bhuta stage that we're going to read about in this next verse. So I'll say, you say. Brahma-Bhuta prasannatma na shochati na kankshati samak sarvesu bhuteshu man bhaktim labhate param. One who is thus transcendentally situated at once realizes the supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments or desires to have anything. He is equally disposed toward every living entity. In that state, he attains pure devotional service unto me. And just a note on the language. Srila Prabhupada learned English in 1906 or so, when he was living in Calcutta. And so in those days, the male pronoun was used to mean everybody. When he says he, it doesn't mean that she's can't do it. This is for everybody, men and women together. So, but we don't use that language. He was, you know, a Bengali gentleman who learned English from the English. So this is the way it sounds. But don't be put off by it. Purport. To the impersonalist, achieving the Brahma-Bhuta stage, becoming one with the Absolute, is the last word. To the impersonalist. But we're not impersonalists. We're personalists. But for the personalist or pure devotee, one has to go still further to become engaged in pure devotional service. This means that one who is engaged in pure devotional service to the Supreme Lord is already in a state of liberation, called Brahma-Bhuta, oneness with the Absolute. Without being one with the Supreme, the Absolute, one cannot render service unto Him. In the Absolute conception, there is no difference between the served and the servitor. Yet the distinction is there in the higher spiritual sense. In the material concept of life, when one works for sense gratification, there is misery. But in the absolute world, when one is engaged in pure devotional service, there is no misery. The devotee in Krishna consciousness has nothing for which to lament or desire. Since God is full, a living entity who is engaged in God's service in Krishna consciousness becomes also full in himself. He is just like a river cleansed of all dirty water. Because a pure devotee has no thought other than Krishna, he is naturally always joyful. He does not lament for any material loss or aspire for gain, because he is full in the service of the Lord. He has no desire for material enjoyment, because he knows that every living entity is a fragmental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, and therefore eternally a servant. He does not see in the material world someone as higher or someone as lower. Higher and lower positions are ephemeral, and a devotee has nothing to do with ephemeral appearances or disappearances. For him, stone and gold are of equal value. This is the Brahma-Bhuta stage, and this stage is attained very easily by the pure devotee. In that stage of existence, the idea of becoming one with the Supreme Brahman and annihilating one's individuality becomes hellish. The idea of attaining the heavenly kingdom becomes phantasmagoria, and the senses are like serpents whose poison teeth are broken. As there is no fear of a serpent with broken teeth, there is no fear from the senses when they are automatically controlled. The world is miserable for the materially infected person, but for a devotee, the entire world is as good as Vaikuntha or the spiritual sky. The highest personality in this material universe is no more significant than an ant for a devotee. Such a stage can be achieved by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, who preached pure devotional service in this age. So, Brahma-Bhuta Pasanana. This Brahma-Bhuta stage is mentioned also at the end of the 14th chapter, when Krishna talks about transcending the modes. You remember I mentioned the modes of nature at the beginning. So this is the stage of pure goodness beyond the modes. That means complete peacefulness. Even in described in the 6th chapter also, in the stage when Krishna is speaking about samadhi. Some of you may have heard about samadhi. If you study yoga or about yoga, this samadhi is full absorption in the object of meditation. So Krishna describes that in the 6th chapter, text 20 to 23, I think it is. And he says that even in the greatest difficulty, one is not disturbed. And having attained this state, he thinks there's no greater state that one can attain. And you experience spiritual happiness through spiritual senses informed by your pure intelligence. It's a very high state of being. And that's what's being described here, this Brahma-Bhuta stage. And the first installment is Prasanatma. Remember I mentioned that we're naturally very joyful. So rising above these modes and being fully situated in one's natural Krishna consciousness, one becomes naturally joyful. Because that's what Krishna is. Krishna is Anandamaya Vyasat. He's full of ananda. Everything he does is full of ananda. You know Krishna. Everyone knows Krishna with playing the flute. He's playing. Ultimately, he's playing all the time. You know? He's playing with his friends, he's playing with his parents, he's evoking all these loving exchanges. He's playing. He wants to do it. Play is something that you want to do. If you have to do it, it's not play anymore. Right? all these professional athletes, they started out playing on the field with their friends, but now they're working for money. You know, going to work and beating each other up on the football field or whatever they're doing. You know. But Krishna is always playing. He wants to do it. So isn't it wonderful to just contemplate for a minute that the highest state that we can be in is eternally playing, eternally doing what we want to do out of pure love and pure joy. That's actually the spiritual world. So the beginning stage, that says prasannatma, Brahma-Bhuta. And there's no shochati and no kanchati. Shochati means lamentation and kanchati means hankering or desiring. If you think about it, this world is full of those things. Right? We want something and we work hard for it. We're dreaming about it. And then maybe if we can, we get it. Or we get some of it. You know? But then we have the experience and it's in the rearview mirror now. Now we can't sustain that experience, whatever it may be, that was pleasurable. Right? Everyone's had experience. You can only enjoy so much. You can only eat so much. You can only do all these other things so much with the senses. So now it's in the back. And it's just a memory. Now maybe you can do it again for a certain amount of time, but at a certain point you can't do it anymore. And so you're lamenting for what you've lost. or you get some money and you lose it. This whole world is full of lamentation. So many trillions of dollars of so-called value people thought they had have slipped through their fingers, whether it's in their house or in their pension fund or they don't work anymore. You're all going to school. Well, you hope to get a job, right, when you graduate, but you're not so sure anymore as it used to be. We know that. So that's a source of fear. And so this is lamentation and hankering. But if you're on the Brahma-Buddha stage and you're hooked up to the reservoir of pleasure that we all contain within ourselves, we all have within our heart this infinite ability to enjoy spiritual pleasure, then these external things don't bother you so much. It comes and it goes. The material world is going to give you a hard time. You're going into the Navy soon, right? So that, you know, it may be smooth, maybe not so smooth. You never know, you know. So that's a... But if you're situated in Krishna consciousness, whatever happens, you know, it'll be easier to tolerate. Let me put it that way. You can more easily tolerate the dualities of this world when you're situated on this problem. So nashochati, nakanchati. And then samak sarveshu bhuteshu means that you see everyone equally. You see them as spirit, not matter. Old, young, male, female, everyone is a spirit soul. And if you relate to them on that platform, then that's true brotherhood and sisterhood. Otherwise, you see the externals, black, white, old, young, you know. She's my brother, they're not, they're my enemies. Look, they have a different color. See, this is gross ignorance. You see people on the spiritual platform, you know, because you see we're all related to Krishna. You know, we're all family. And you can actually see like that. Then, mad bhaktim labhate param. In that state, you can truly attain this devotion to Krishna, to God. You can be situated in that happy state. And that's our eternal nature, to be in that state. So Prabhupada describes that state here. Now what he's describing at the end, he's quoting a verse from a great sage who lived in the 16th century. And he wrote about this figure called Lord Chaitanya. I haven't mentioned Lord Chaitanya, but Prabhupada mentions him at the end. Lord Chaitanya is a more modern figure. We have two basic dates, 5,000 years ago and 500 years ago. So 5,000 years ago, this book was spoken on this battlefield by Krishna. 500 years ago, Krishna came again as Chaitanya in order to teach us how to practice bhakti in a very easy way. You know, because this list up here in text 51-53, it's hard to imagine how we can attain that on our own, you know. But the chanting of the holy name. Here's the one, the chanting and dancing, which we're famous for, Hare Krishna, you know. That's called Sankirtan. And that chanting that mantra and dancing and chanting on the streets. You know, no one really knows what's going on. But that's, we're actually practicing yoga. This is called Bhakti Yoga, Mantra Yoga. Mantra means you take this powerful formula of words. And this especially is called the Maha Mantra, the great mantra for deliverance. The very word mantra means tra, deliver, the man, mind. A sound vibration that delivers the mind from ignorance. So, Krishna came himself, and as Chaitanya, in order to teach us this simple process. Don't worry about, you know, forget about going off to the forest, you know, and standing on your head. You don't need to do that, you know. You can do it for health, but don't think, you know, this is the best process, is this dancing and chanting together, this holy name. Hare Krishna. And then one can easily come, easily and happily and joyfully come to this Brahma-Buddha stage. So he quotes a verse here. I'll give you the Sanskrit. It's very beautiful. Kaivalyam nadakayate chudashapura kasha pushpayate durdandenduyakara sarvapatali protkata dangstrayate vishvam purna sukhayate vidimahindra adishtakitayate yet karunya kataksha vaivapatam tam gauram evastumaha. So there's a great devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu named Prabodhananda Saraswati. Prabodhananda Saraswati means a learned sage. He was very skilled in writing poetry, music, and everything. And he was a devotee of Krishna. And he wrote this about Lord Chaitanya. So what he says there is that one who has been empowered, who has been blessed by the merciful glance of Lord Chaitanya, he sees merging into the absolute and losing one's identity as worse than going to hell. You know, because if we're going to try to engage in this eternal loving relationship with God, with Krishna, then we have to be eternal, and we have to see the form of the Lord separate from us, and there has to be that exchange of loving devotion and service, you see. As soon as you merge, you lose your identity, which you can do for some time, but not forever. There's no more bhakti. There's no devotion. I am you, and you are me, and we are all together. There's no relation. You have to be a difference, you see. So that kaivalyam means oneness is hellish, not a kayate. And all of these, there are different levels of existence. We see this one planet. But actually there are higher planes of existence where their life is longer, there are wonderful enjoyments on this heaven, we call heavenly planets, swarga. And we see that the devotee who has been empowered in this way, he feels that these are just phantasmagoria. They're imaginary. Who cares? You know, I don't want to go there. And then the difficult to control senses, called durdantendriya, they're like poisonous serpents. We're always being victimized by our senses. You know, suppose you smoke a cigarette. You know, then anyone who's ever done that, I used to smoke for about 8 years when I was a kid back in the 60s. And, you know, there comes a point where, oh, I gotta have a cigarette, gotta have a cigarette. You're being victimized. You want to quit? All right, I'm going to quit. But not so easy. You know, the demands are there, and you know, you break down again. So that's called the durdantendriya kala sarpa. But here, when the Krishna conscious in this way, protkata dangstrayate, they've lost their fangs. You may see a big cobra coming out, you know, suppose it comes out of the door there. Whoa, whoa, whoa. But then he opens his mouth and there's no fangs in there. Who cares? You slap him around. You know? He may look like just like a cobra, but he has no potency. See? So the senses don't have any potency to bother you anymore because they're always engaged in Krishna consciousness. So that's the third line here. So the idea is that getting the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, chanting his holy name, one can surpass all other yogas. One can take the elevator, the rapid elevator to the highest stage of yoga, beyond karma yoga and jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge, speculation, dhyana yoga, severe meditation, artificial sitting alone for many months and years. We can't do it. Don't bother. Just chant Hare Krishna. Dance. And you'll see that you'll become a yogi right away. Any questions on these points? We're almost coming to, we're going to have a ceremony in a few minutes. Hopefully you can stay. Anyone have any questions? Come on, Timmy. Yes, go ahead.
Actually, I was wondering earlier about what's the principle behind understanding whether knowledge is authoritative or bona fide knowledge, or if it's just kind of if you should be skeptical about it. Because I'll give the example. My dad, he's about 70 now, and he says that I'm 70 years old, so I know the world. So what he's saying, what I'm saying is authoritative.
Right.
So because the principle there is because I've seen the world. But what's the objective understanding of whether something is authoritative?
Well, it's not just age. You know, someone can be an old fool or he can be an old wise person. Depends on their experience and who they've been taught by. The thing is, we come into this world, we don't know anything. We need instruction. Our first instructors, of course, are parents. Right? You learn so much in the first 5 years from your parents, your siblings, your environment, you know. And throughout life, we're always learning. But the question is the quality of the knowledge. And this is why we have in Krishna consciousness, in yoga, what we call a disciplic succession. The original teacher is Krishna. We're very fortunate here. Krishna is speaking this book. This is called Bhagavad Gita, the song of Bhagavan. Bhagavan is a word that means the Supreme Lord, or Krishna. So that's something that, you know, we can have faith in. Now, but it's not just that, well, how do we know that this was spoken by Krishna? How do we know that this is... So there's a whole line of teachers who were themselves at once students. Just like now, and everything, the student becomes the teacher in the next generation. So who have become realized in this knowledge. And the symptoms or the characteristics are, yes, they become peaceful. Yes, they've obviously detached. You know, living very simply, but they're very joyful. You know, they're obviously not. You know, they're not socking away any millions of dollars somewhere. You know, you can see they're living like mendicants. We have in our line stories of the six Goswamis and so many others. It's a great story, actually. These we call Goswamis. Some of them were extremely wealthy. They mostly live in the 16th century. We're going back, and they had high positions in government. But they began this process, and they tapped into this unlimited source of joy in their heart. They gave up their money. They gave up their position. They wandered like mendicants, monks in Vrindavan, this holy place. But they were always overflowing with this happiness. Materially, they were as poor as you can be. They didn't even have homes. They were living under a tree with a little loincloth. You know, you can't get any poorer than that. You know, but it wasn't like these poor homeless guys here, who are just thinking, how can I get the next can and turn it in for a nickel? It's not like that. They were richest. They were meditating on Krishna. They were overflowing with happiness, and so they were full of knowledge. They wrote wonderful books. You see, so there's a whole line like that who have practiced this knowledge and realized it and taught it. So by practical experience, you can see what's the result of the knowledge. Now, someone may say, I know this world, but are they free of hankering? Are they free of lamentation? You know, are they always fully joyful? Or is there's a lot of like, oh, the world is a veil of tears? No, I'm sorry. You know, for the realized soul who really knows, there's no veil of tears. They're never unhappy. Even in the greatest difficulty, you can become tolerant. We're going to have to stop now because I'm going to start a ceremony here. But thank you for your attention. Please stay another 15 minutes. You'll see an RT and a kirtan, and we have a little prasadam, sacred food for everybody. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.